Okay. But they were looking for some new projects. Alphonse Pachukas wandered into the research laboratory in Schenectady and was shown what was left of the mallet.
Mm-hmm.
And it was demonstrated for him that he could pound it and do all sorts of things with it. And he said, "What is it?" And they said, "Well, it's a polycarbonate." And his first response was, "It can't be." "Why can't it be?" "Because all polycarbonates are brittle." "They're not all brittle." "They're all brittle. I know, because I spent the last 6 or 8 years with Pittsburgh plate glass, wearing a must cap and strain, I think, where there's an awful lot of aliphatic polycarbonate work." And he said, "Everything we made was brittle." And he said, "That's the polycarbonate I want for my new development operation in Pittsburgh." And I don't know the exact wording, but apparently he was told he couldn't have it immediately because they had plans to look at it.
But nobody was looking at it.
Nobody was looking at it. He said that literally gave him an ultimatum. If you don't do something within the next 6 weeks or whatever the period he set, he said, "I'm taking it." So 6 weeks went by and he took it.
Mm-hmm.
And brought it to Pittsburgh.
And you were still over there?
I was still at Turbine Laboratory.
And you weren't even involved in this little...
I was involved in that.
Had you applied for patents on this at all at this point?
Yes.
While you were still at the research lab?
Yes. Well, I think so.
Careful, you're hooked up.
Mm-hmm. All right. I can't see. What's the application date on here somewhere?
55.
That's not a patent.
55.
Well, I had not applied for a patent, no.
Yeah.
But you,
so I had written the disclosure.
Yeah.
You wrote one. So, in other words, you recognized this was important to write a disclosure.
I wrote the disclosure in suits.
Mm-hmm.
And the disclosure was on, and there was a little bit of haggling with my boss at Turbine that I had invented this stuff on his payroll at the research laboratory, and it was taken over by Plastic. A little bit of haggling about that, but anyhow, it did come to Pittsfield, and there are some good guys here, Pittsfield. But meantime, I was at Turbine Lab, and whenever I had a chance, I was making polycarbonate. And
this was something that genuinely interested you, and it was almost as though it was a project that you could do on the side on the QT.
Like I was doing it without interfering with my regular routine work. And my boss knew it. If I interfered a little bit, he didn't care.
It wasn't the central issue with which you were involved on
no.
a day-to-day basis.
It was a
that was still wired.
Probably 25% of my time or more for a year.
Did you have an assistant? Were you, in other words, were you a lonely chemist in a laboratory? Or?
No, I had a lab tech.
Who was your lab tech?
My lab tech at the time, one of them was a guy named Bob Baratel, who ended up as a engineer down at Louisville. Very responsible. That's in a technician with of much consequence.
You did a lot of most of your own experimental work yourself, I think. Yeah.
Yes. I had a number of experiences and I continue to work back and forth with the wire thing with the research laboratory finished our meetings and stuff, mm-hmm. so I did maintain good contact there.
But you didn't make any effort to get them to work on the polycarbonate pool.
I was a guest.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
What was your familiarity with the polymer literature at the time?
Almost none, and that's the thing. If I had looked in the literature before I made my first hydroquinone arsenal attempt, I would have found that that had already been done twice,
sure.
in 1898 and 1902 or 4,
mm-hmm.
and with the same results I had,
yeah.
except they had tried some different approaches, and I'd also found out that they did a transesterification, but they used dichromyl carbonate, and I found that worked by accident rather than by checking loose. I just didn't, it wasn't part of my training, part of my thinking, part of anything to go see
mm-hmm.
What had happened in history, historically. Just didn't recognize it.
Carruthers went through that same business because with all the polyesters that they synthesized, they didn't look at the literature either, and they passed right by the carbonate. You're in good company.
Well, anyhow, that was I got educated after the fact.
But had anyone done this diphenyl carbonate plus bisphenol reaction before?
No.
Why do you think no one?
Well, I can give you a couple of reasons. One is that everybody knew that carbonates were easily hydrolyzed, and therefore it wouldn't be the basis for a decent polymer. And the other reason is that bisphenol A was not an item of commerce until about 2 years before that, when a guy named Chastan and a couple others, Greenway, discovered epoxy resin. And they needed a bisphenol for it, so they made bisphenol. And for the same token here, if you looked in the literature, which I did, prior to 1950, there were cases where terephthalic acid and isophthalic acid were considered rare chemicals with no commercial application. And they are the guts of our polyester business in the States is £6.5 billion a year. But they had been uncovered or discovered by Winfield and Dixon in Europe. Carruthers had bypassed them. And Winfield and Dixon discovered them, but they discovered them during the war. And they were closed down from a secrecy standpoint, so they weren't even available until after the Second World War, which meant about 1946 or 47 is the first time they were even talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ignorance was pretty general.
Mm-hmm.
As far as carbonates, I say, I've been taught in organic chemistry that carbonate could be used as a blocking agent, a temporary blocking agent, because it's easily hydrolyzed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think everybody else was. And if I hadn't tangled with the glycol carbonate, I would still think it was. So there was no good reason no good reason to consider the use of a carbonate and bisphenol A. In the case of Bayer's situation, they claimed they did it by foresight and planning, but I sort of doubt it.
Well, Mylar and Dacron everything kind of came out at the same time, so it's unlikely that
I'll tell you what spurred our whole magnet wire thing on. That was the availability and appreciation of the fact that ethylene glycol terephthalate was a hell of a good polymer with great insulation properties.
Mm-hmm.
That it was a thermoplastic which had crystalline problems and couldn't tough if it's crystalline, and too low melting or too low softening if it weren't crystalline. It just wasn't of any use for wire coating, but that's the thing that served as the basis for how I looked at that material. Up to that point, almost all attempts at high temperature varnishing stuff were based on phthalic anhydride, which is terrible because whenever it gets hot, it cracks the varnish.
Mm-hmm.
So it has no thermal stability, but that was the only common acid that was used in insulation. But the availability of terephthalic acid and isophthalic acid as a consequence of the 1941 or 42 discovery of Winfield and Dixon made the whole thing possible. And we actually took mylar film, which we were using for electrical insulation, and boiled it up in pheno, a solvent or freeso, and tried to use it for varnish, and it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
First, it's not very soluble,
yeah.
And it's just terrible. But then the question was, can we modify that to break up the crystallinity and make it soluble? And then can we cross-link it? And everybody knows that cross-linked polyesters are brittle, so we'll put some oil in. That was the evolution of the thing. And it went right through it.
That's really interesting, that aspect of it. You know, I would have almost thought that the oil part of it was the upfront part, and then you found that you didn't need the drying oils afterwards.
We had made a product that they called siliconese, prior to the Alkanet, and what they were doing there was trying to substitute silicon oil, if you will, for the normal drying oil.
Yeah.
And here they had a product that was reasonably thermally stable and it wouldn't evaporate or go away at high temperature, but it had little to no mechanical properties.
Mm-hmm.
And so they threw out the silicone oil modification and went to the natural oil. And incidentally, we were not alone there. Dow Corning had an almost identical product, which to GE's product, which contained silicone oil, and they got patents on that. And what happened is that as they found out their product was slow curing and didn't have much in line of properties, they kept reducing the amount of silicone modification they put in it until they got down to extremely low silicone content. And what they were really doing is waving the silicone oil over our Alkanex and calling it
mm-hmm.
their product. We sued them, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Stop them from playing around our neighborhood, the backyard. But they too approached a similar product by a backwards way.
Mm-hmm.
But I might add, from a personal standpoint, that the Alkanex ended up being fought in patent courts all around the world, and I had the opportunity from a new employee to essentially be commuting to Europe for a while,
mm-hmm.
Which was pretty rare in those days. And I've been in court in England on a number of occasions. I've been in court in France, in patent court, and I've been in court in Stockholm. I've been in court in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
For about a year or so, I was courting, if you will, which is a kind of exciting thing,
mm-hmm.
To go argue in court. One of the famous ones was in Stockholm, where the court was hearing was conducted in Swedish, and we were opposing a German company, and they were speaking in German, and
mm-hmm.
our French partners, subsidiary from Thompson Houston, they were there arguing French. I was trying to speak in English. It was just like the Tower of Babel. Unfortunately, we had a couple of very capable patent representatives who could handle anything.
Mm-hmm.
It was really amazing. That provided a little, you know, insight. But coming back here, they started a program here. The person in charge of the development here was really a guy named Bill Kess, who ended up at, he left the company, went ahead of research and established the Owens Corning Fiberglass Research Laboratory that Graham built. And then he left there and went to Northeastern. I think he finished up the college at Prospect Northeastern. Hell of a nice guy. And another guy who was their principal creative individual here on the spot was Gene Goldberg. He is at Florida, or Florida State now, after a long, very excellent career, mostly at Xerox, and retired down there, and he's doing research on last I knew polymers which are going to kidney stones, but also they are cross-linked polyamides as well, for the most part. But he was the brightest person in Chicago at the time.
These all worked with chemical development operations.
They worked with chemical development. Cass had the engineer, or the chemistry part of the chemical development.
This would have been under Petrucas?
Petrucas had the development,
mm-hmm.
And under him, Petrucas ended up shortly thereafter becoming a corporate consultant down in New York City. Another interesting person was here welcomed me on the job as my boss's boss was Bob Kriebel. And he told me how much I'd like it here. And about 2 months later, I made a 50-cent contribution to his farewell party because he left to start Loctite. he was a boss, the head of the boss. I guess Petrucas moved on shortly to corporate consulting shortly after he brought the project over here.
Mm-hmm.
They had it gone more than a year by the time I came here. I came here in, I guess, January of 56 or December of 55.
How did you come? Did Petrucas go down and recruit you out of the turbine?
yes. Actually, Bill Kess recruited me. He had built up a team, and I was independently playing around with polycarbonate over there and, they were playing in earnest here at the Pittsfield, and we had several which was a communication trip back and forth and stuff, and he asked me how I'd like to come, and I decided to come and follow with the public government.
So you ended up in Pittsfield 1956,
January.
And who was the principal? Who would have been Petrucas' boss? And that would have been Ruben Guthoff?
No, about that time, I think Cass left because he didn't get the job that he thought he should, and Gene Schubert got the job.
So he was running the whole chemical development operation?
No, Gene Schubert was running the chemical development operation.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What was your job exactly then?
I was manager of advanced development. No, I was specialist of advanced development until Schubert left and Guthoff took over. That's when I became manager of advanced development.
Mm-hmm.
But what I spent a lot of time in those days was making copolymers and studying properties and things like that.
So you weren't directly in the main line of commercialization?
In the main line of commercialization, no.
At this point, had decisions been made to commercialize this?
Yes. But decision was made to try and commercialize it, but there was a lot of problems. One, they started their development here initially by trying to duplicate my milk fermentation,
mm-hmm.
and failed. Primarily, almost totally, a mechanical failure. They could not handle the viscosity and temperature and reduced pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Classic was they did twist the shaft off, a 3/4 inch shaft off of a 1 or 2 gallon reactor. They had enough horsepower, but they had a big paddle stirrer in a kettle and stuck that viscous itself, and they kept twisting the shaft off. Well, you don't stir highly viscous materials in big kettles with anchor stirrers.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't anybody here that knew anything about
mm-hmm.
stirring high viscosity material or handling high temperature or anything else. One of the interesting stories I like to tell is that they needed high vacuum, and they needed a lot of surface generation, and they needed high temperature. So they went over to silicone to use a vacuum roll system. There's a couple of rolls that turn in a vacuum and generate a lot of surface and devolatilize them. And they said put a batch of polycarbonate into that and started running it, and the whole damn thing froze up. And they couldn't get it open, couldn't get it apart. Kind of expensive equipment.
Yeah.
And it took them weeks, I guess, to soak it loose and get it apart so it would be operable again. And they literally become persona non grata and went out and showed them business again. But anyhow, they failed mechanically. Then they started looking for other ways of doing this.
Were they still doing this by transesterification?
That's what they're trying.
No polarization, yeah.
They tried, and
yeah.
That was a total failure. Then, turns out, I'm not sure whether he was the one responsible or not, probably Gene Goldberg found that he could, instead of putting caustic in water and trying to fermentize it, he could put your monomer into pyridine and
mm-hmm.
level and phosgene
yeah.
if you make polymer. And all you need to do is figure out how to get rid of pyridine hydrochloride and get rid of all the stench.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way they were going for a while. Then,
so that was really the first
practical
step
way
down
to make
the road.
Polymer.
Yeah, the pure, yeah.
The pyridine.
Yeah.
Then they found that you could use methylene chloride as a diluent in the pyridine. You use pyridine chloride as they add together in the methylene chloride. And that was going.
So now you got an interfacial polymerization.
And then,
yeah.
You know, what came next was to put lime in with the methylene chloride and pyridine, and eventually leave the pyridine out and use lime to get the chlorine. And we actually built our first plant, a 5 million pound plant, employing lime as the acid getter. And then we became aware of the interfacial fermentation and ended up licensing that from Bayer.
Yeah.
But we went through quite a few steps here. Incidentally, I discovered the pyridine thing over in Pittsfield, and so I started making some polymers there, in Pittsfield, but in Connecticut. And I took it to our patent attorney, and our patent attorney was a Pittsfield patent attorney also. He informed me that you're a little bit late, but that's what they're doing over in Pittsfield as of last week or something. But it wasn't until we had a process going that we could make good, consistent polymer that we could really begin to learn something about the product.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that I had a tough product when I made it. It turned out that the IV and the stuff was probably about 0.5, but it had gelatin.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I found out later that I made that polymer rather readily with no catalyst. But I'm checking off every bit of BPA you could obtain at the time had a tenth to a half a percent of lime and all sorts of stuff in it. And all the DPC we had garbage in it.
Yeah.
And I hadn't bothered purifying anything ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I subsequently purified some BPA, very pure, and purified some DPC, very pure, put them together to run a melt polymerization, they don't go. No reaction.
It's really instructive.
So, fortuitously, we had the catalyst.
Yeah.
I say that of interest many years later, we were actually running a melt facility. And one, the reaction was a little bit slow. And one guy on it happened to be eating lunch, and he had one of these little packs of salt from Hamburg thing. And he said, maybe a little salt would help. And he sprinkled a little salt in, and the reaction took off. It was very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And a little salt is a good transparification catalyst.
Mm-hmm.
If you understand why it works.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it works is that, contrary to common teaching, salt reacts with phenol at high temperature to produce HCl and sodium phenol. But if you asked me when I was going to school, I would have said salt is inert. Unless you put acid in. But phenol is strong enough to crack it at temperatures, and this is one of the bad things about having any kind of metal in. If you have any chloride around, sodium chloride, you can destroy your polymer. But when we had our polymer we were making here, I was actively making polymers, as was everybody else. We were aiming at who could make the highest intrinsic viscosity polymer. And it was a challenge, and who could make the best color, because everything was dark brown to begin with. The best color was a long time coming, but the high intrinsic viscosity was relatively easy to make. But when they took the stuff to market, they found out that there was no equipment anywhere to process it. Really no mechanical equipment capable of drawing high enough temperature and enough horsepower to handle very high viscosity polycarbonate. And then we started backing up on it, and we found that we could back the whole way down to almost 4/10 intrinsic viscosity and still have most problems, and we settled a little bit above that by temperature for most of our products. But another thing that happened there was that when we measured the melt viscosity over a period of time, it would either climb or it would fall away or disappear, lose its viscosity, degradation or build. And a lot of this turned out to be due to the impurities in the bisphenol A. One I like to say is that we actually paid Shell Chemical $2.50 a pound for making pure bisphenol A at a time when that was an outrageous price. We bought quite a few tens of thousands of pounds of bisphenol A at $2.50 a pound, and I don't know, but we'll probably could buy the impure stuff for 20 cents a pound, 25 cents a pound. But it was necessary. About, I guess it was 1956, they had reached a point where they were going to, we're talking about going commercial, talking about commercial. And we were going to announce the product, so we picked the Gordon Conference to announce the thing. And before the paper was actually delivered at the Gordon Conference, I think, Schnell, who was the buyer, inventor, announced the same product.
At the same Gordon Conference?
No, that's not. They had it in a German publication.
Yeah.
We got it. So, this sort of shook up the place a bit.
Let's pause for one second here.